This podcast is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity, like Progressive home and auto policies. They're best when bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When I brought Slate's Jeremy Stahl into the studio on Wednesday and asked for a little update on Donald Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan, he wanted to start by clearing up some rumors you may have heard.
I don't know if you remember at the start of the trial, there were accusations that he was sleeping throughout jury selection and all that. Well, apparently he's just closing his eyes to try to maintain his cool so he doesn't explode.
Jeremy knows all this because every day at 7 a.m., he heads to the courthouse and gets in line to claim his seat. And he brings binoculars with him so he can see exactly what's happening up front. What I'm saying is, by now, he knows a whole lot about Donald J. Trump's eyes.
They're closed all day. All day, every day. He briefly will open his eyes to have conversations with his attorneys, but for the most part, his eyes are closed.
Like he's just letting it wash over him.
Exactly. Or pretending it's not happening. I don't know.
Honestly, for a lot of the last couple of weeks, Jeremy kind of got this boredom or whatever it was.
We were listening to witness testimony from accountants the previous like day and a half.
Spreadsheets.
I'd
be napping too.
It was a series of vouchers and invoices and signed checks. And then we get in on Tuesday and it's like, it's stormy day. It's happening. This is real. And she did not disappoint.
Stormy, of course, is Stormy Daniels, the woman at the heart of this case. The woman who alleges she had sex with Trump back in 2006 and then got paid $130,000 to shut up about it when Trump ran for president in 2016. In true Trump fashion, he had teased Stormy's appearance, posting his displeasure on Truth Social. He said his lawyers hadn't had time to prepare their cross-examination. He said the judge was crooked and highly conflicted. Soon after, Trump deleted this post, which may have something to do with the fact that the judge here has fined him thousands of dollars for violating a gag order. Then Stormy took the stand, and she had a lot to say.
Yesterday was very, very messy. There was a journalist, a seat or two in front of me, who turned around and said to everybody, "That was flippin' insane. That was flippin' insane."
Today on the show, who is holding their tongue and who isn't at Trump's criminal trial? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Jeremy says, so far, there have been three witnesses you should pay special attention to in this case. Stormy Daniels, Hope Hicks, and David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer.
He laid out as the very first witness just the full picture of what prosecutors are alleging the conspiracy was to influence that election, to hide negative stories about Donald Trump, not just negative stories, but potential huge scandals about Donald Trump by paying off women who would accuse him of things, right? They gathered at Trump Tower in August, immediately after Trump announced his presidency, with David Pecker, with Michael Cohen, with Donald Trump, and laid out this plan to do this. And then they did every element of the plan. And David Pecker laid out how that happened, why it was necessary.
Wow. When you put it like that, it's like, huh, sounds like a conspiracy.
That's the allegation, is that it was a conspiracy. And that is basically what David Pecker described, which is why his opening witness testimony was so useful, valuable to the prosecution. He just came off as this old skeezy tabloid journalist who didn't have any shame about what his job was, which is to peddle celebrity gossip.
Okay, so David Pecker kind of set the stage for everyone. Then we have these other folks coming forward. Hope Hicks first. Remind my listeners who Hope Hicks is and why it was such a big deal that she took the stand.
Hope Hicks was Donald Trump's, when he was at the Trump Organization, she was a PR professional, and she had previously been a crisis communications manager. She was a PR professional for the Trump Org. She became his press secretary during the campaign almost immediately. And then when he was elected president, she became his director of communications. And she seemed almost like a surrogate Trump family member during that Trump presidency in terms of her closeness to the first family, and in terms of just how she was another mouthpiece and voice of the Trump family.
So a big deal for someone like that to actually take the stand here.
Yes, she testified against Donald Trump, mind you. She testified against her old boss. She gave prosecutors pretty damning accounts of conversations she had with Donald Trump after the Stormy story finally broke open. He, according to Hope Hicks's testimony, said to her, it's better that it happened now instead of before the election, right? And that is a key claim of what prosecutors are saying, is they wanted to cover this up prior to the election. He wasn't trying to protect his family.
Because publicly, Stormy Daniels' story came out after Donald Trump was in office, and the story was about killing the story before he was in office.
That's exactly right. The story came out in early 2018. The allegation is that in 2016, in days before the election, after the Access Hollywood tape had come out, Michael Cohen paid off Stormy Daniels to keep the story quiet so that the public would never hear it.
So what was the main thing you took away from Hope Hicks' testimony?
Well, she gave both sides something. So she described Trump as a family man and caring about Melania Trump's opinions and all that. But she also described how Donald Trump was very concerned about how the story was playing, the Stormy Daniels story was playing, and how it affected his presidency. And she also broke down on the stand.
She broke down in tears, right?
Well, I saw her dab her eye, and everyone assured me that she was crying, and I saw her dab her eye. She had to pause. And this was literally after the first question of cross-examination. And it was just a question of, so, how was your time at the Trump Organization? It was like the most banal question ever, essentially. And this is what set her off. And like, I could see how testifying against your old boss in such a high-profile circumstance might have had that impact on somebody. And I can also see that she is a crisis communications manager.
Okay. So then this week, Stormy Daniels takes the stand. What struck you about her when she walked in the room?
She seemed more composed, more. She's in a very tough situation, right? This is a very challenging set of circumstances that she has to describe, a very tough period of her life that she has to describe. And she came off to me as composed, smart, thoughtful and at the same time not like Hope Hicks, not having rehearsed this to the point of perfection. She was rambling on. She was going into way too much detail. She was adding elements to the story that were completely unnecessary, so much so to the point that the judge had to and the prosecutor had to repeatedly ask her to slow down her testimony so that the trial reporter could actually get down what she was saying.
What are some of the things she was saying that surprised you?
She said so much, and a lot of it has been in previous books and things like that, but a lot of it was new. She talked about how she arrived at this Trump residence after having met him at a golf course. Trump came up to her afterward during the course of the tournament, introduced himself, like they did with all the celebrities, but he took a particular interest in her. And according to this testimony, he invited her to dinner. She shows up at his bungalow. First of all, he's in his pajamas for dinner. He's in silk pajamas when she shows up. She tells him to go put some clothes on. And she said, "Did you steal that from Hugh Hefner?" And like, she was a little bit funny. She kept making jokes about the adult film industry that only she was laughing at because it was kind of awkward for everyone else in the room. But she described how they spoke for a couple of hours. She had to use the restroom. She went into the restroom and started prying through his toiletry bag, which she said she was not proud of. And she found Old Spice, Pert Plus, and gold tweezers in there. And all of this was to add credibility to her story. The details were necessary in order to demonstrate this happened to her. Because on cross-examination, they're going to say it's all a lie. And that's what they're saying already. It's all a lie.
But then when did the details become more than just kind of proving her credibility?
Yeah, they became too much right around that point. She described how when she got out of the restroom, he was on the bed in boxers. And then he sort of like blocked her exit from the bedroom. And she says the next thing she knew, they were on the bed sleeping together. And then the prosecution asked a series of questions probing about whether or not he was wearing a condom. But they asked it in the most kind of gross ways you could think of. The word skin was used, and like, the objections were not quick enough, I would say. And the other thing that she did say that the judge himself cut off, I believe, was that she said something like, "He said to me, 'You don't want to go back to the trailer park, do you?'" And that was the most coercive and horrible thing that he could have said to her. She said that, and the judge struck it from the record. The judge said, "Jury, you heard that. You're not allowed to have heard that. You have to pretend like you did not hear that."
So she's describing an encounter that is not affirmatively consensual. You know, like she's not saying no to whatever's happening, but she's also not talking about being fully present for it. She talked about kind of blacking out, right?
Yeah, that part was a little bit confusing because she was trying to clarify that she had not had anything to drink except for water. Neither of them had anything to drink from water. She said, "I wasn't drugged or anything like that, but I don't remember how that I made that move from one spot to the other." And that was another part where the claim was that it was too prejudicial. But she was trying to make a point, which was this was a sudden thing that she didn't even understand happening in real time. And yes, it read as sexual coercion, bordering on sexual assault. And that is a really horrible story to have presented in open court.
Trump's lawyers asked for a mistrial after her testimony. Was it basically just because this testimony was too much?
So the judge beforehand said, "You can go into some detail, but don't go into too much, because otherwise it's unduly prejudicial to the defendant. This is a case about falsifying documents. This is a case about covering up hush money before the election. This is not a sexual case. If you go into all these sexual details, they'll view the defendant in a different light, and it will hurt him in a way that is unfair," right? But also, the defense has made Stormy Daniels' credibility a key part of this case and question her credibility. So in order to prove her credibility, the prosecutors do need to offer some of her detailed memories. So the judge gave this sort of vague direction to the prosecutors to both rein it in, but also you have some you're allowed to do a little bit of this probing. And it just went wild from there. It just went wild. And you can see both sides of the argument. And ultimately, afterwards, Trump's team asked for a mistrial, said too much was revealed. And what the judge said was, you weren't objecting nearly fast enough to this stuff.
Like, if you thought this was bad, you should have been jumping in there.
If you thought this was bad, you had every opportunity to object. I sustained almost all of your objections. When you did object, the questions were stopped. So you could have done that, and you were a little bit slow on the gun. Judge Mershon said, I jumped in at one point and stopped something before you did. So that was your role. And I agree that the prosecution needed to establish credibility. I agree that this witness was, quote unquote, hard to control. He said, I tried to control her and I couldn't do it. So there is no mistrial.
One of my producers has noted, you really can say too much at trials like this. Just a couple weeks back, Harvey Weinstein's conviction in New York was overturned because the jury was given too much information about his behavior that didn't directly relate to the crime that was being prosecuted. By giving so much detail about Stormy Daniels' encounter with Trump, is the prosecution risking something like that?
There is a risk. There was a risk that the judge could have said, yeah, there's grounds for a mistrial here. He didn't, but there is also the risk of the situation you just described, where on appeal it's overturned because the jury heard information that didn't relate to the evidence and the charges, and it was prejudicial to the defendant. At the same time, Trump's team could have been more quick on those objections. They could have done more to stop what they didn't want the jury to hear. And if their case is that she's a liar, she's going to need to establish her credibility even more.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
While people have been testifying in this case, there's also been drama outside the courtroom, which is kind of bleeding into the proceedings, which is all coming from Trump himself and his the fact that he goes on social media about what's happening and how fair that is. Tell me a little bit about what Trump is able to do and what he is doing.
So Trump is not supposed to target witnesses in his statements, or the jury, or family members of the court or prosecutorial staff in any way that could reasonably be foreseen to result in them facing real threats. That is a gag order that the judge placed at the start of these proceedings, and he's been fined $11,000 for it so far.
He's being fined $1,000 for each violation?
So the issue that Judge Mershon faces is that all he has in his toolkit is a $1,000 fine per violation and jail. Jailing the former president with the Secret Service, or a $1,000 fine, which is meaningless to
a billionaire.
However much money the man has. So he has had to threaten Donald Trump with jail.
How has Trump talked about these gag orders as they've been piling up one after another?
He's talking about his First Amendment rights being violated. It's a horrible abuse of the Constitution, all these things. And he's also suggested that he'd be willing to go to jail in order to protect his own First Amendment rights and in order to protect the Constitution and these great principles that he has, obviously.
How many times can Mershon use the words jail but not back them up with actual jail?
He can't do it again. he's given his warning. He said, I've done everything in my power not to jail you, essentially. So, like, he can't let it happen. It to my mind, if he talks about the jury one more time, or if he talks about another witness specifically who has not talked about him first one more time, I don't know what option this judge has.
In general, it seems to me like the judge is trying to both control Trump's behavior, but preserve Trump's dignity, I guess. Like, when Stormy Daniels was testifying, Trump reportedly started cursing. And the judge brought his lawyer up to the stand and said, like, listen, this is a witness intimidation, but also, like, I'm bringing you up here because I don't want to embarrass him. What did you make of that encounter?
So I didn't know about that encounter till reading it the next day in the transcript. I don't think any reporter did. There's no way for us to know. We can't hear what we're not close enough to hear him say that. But apparently the judge heard him, saw him shaking his head, I guess, and like, again, muttering to himself, which happened earlier in the trial as well, and called the attorneys to his seat and instructed specifically defense attorneys, tell your client that this is unacceptable. I won't allow it. It's contemptuous. But I'm doing this in conference so that it is not seen in front of the jury, essentially. So yes, he's walking this tightrope where he's trying to keep order in this courtroom and at the same time not be a fire breather down Donald Trump's neck.
Politico's Ankush Kardori made the argument that even if Trump doesn't face jail time now for what he's saying inside and outside of court, his repeated violations of gag orders make it more likely he could get prison time later if he's convicted. Does that seem accurate to you?
Ankush is so smart and so good at what he does and knows these things way better than I do, so I trust him. I hadn't heard that. What I have heard is that if he's convicted, the judge has the power to A, collect his passport, B, tell him that if he leaves the island of Manhattan, he needs judicial permission each time he does so, and C, have him wear an ankle monitor. And this man is running for president, going to be on a presidential campaign. So maybe these contempt violations and these attacks on jurors and witnesses will give Judge Marchand something to think about when he's deciding this question, which is completely within his and his jurisdiction alone.
On Monday, prosecutors said they need a couple more weeks to finish their case, and then the defense will take over. What are you expecting in the days ahead?
We still haven't heard from Michael Cohen. We haven't heard from Karen McDougal. It's unclear whether Karen McDougal is going to testify.
This is another woman with a very similar story to Stormy Daniels.
Correct. This is a former Playboy playmate, Karen McDougal, who said that she had like a year-long affair with Donald Trump. And we're almost also certain to hear from Michael Cohen. We have to hear from Michael Cohen, to be totally honest. And that is going to be wild.
How much longer do we have here? I mean, it's been 2 weeks, but it sounds like we have like four more at least.
No, they're moving very fast.
Oh.
Everyone's saying they're moving very fast. The judge is saying they're moving very fast. The prosecutors are saying they're moving very fast. Week after next, at the latest, is when prosecution says they think they'll expect to be done. They think they could even wrap as soon as the end of next week. After that, the defense is expected to present a very, very short case. They had a very, very short witness list. They might recall some witnesses. But unless they put on Donald Trump, which who knows at this point? Honestly, who knows? I have no idea. Unless they put on Donald Trump, it will be a very light defense.
You know, late on Tuesday, we learned Trump's classified documents case in Florida has been postponed indefinitely, which to me just puts an even brighter spotlight on this case in New York, because it really is the one case that's likely to move forward before November. And I think at the beginning, a lot of people said, oh, this case, it's small. It's not really that big of a deal. But you've been in the courtroom. Have you reassessed your take on this? I'm not sure you were ever one of those people who said this was not a big deal, but I just wonder, is this case taking on renewed importance given everything that's happened over the last week with all the other cases?
I think people who were skeptical before are taking, even if they remain skeptical, are taking it more seriously. I think the significance of a criminal conviction and a felonious presidential candidate is going to hit home if and when it actually happens, when there's a verdict against him. But people are starting to see that this is the only path to that happening and are understanding that, oh, maybe these charges aren't so piddling after all, right? Because it's a lot that they were doing. You know, one journalist said to me, it's not $130,000 payoff, right? It's incalculable amounts of money to support all the negotiations and steps and secret deals and added stories against his opponents and stories for him, all the exposure and defense and protection that he was getting as part of this. It's incalculable the amount of help it did to him to have these tabloids protecting him on supermarket shelves across the country. Everyone, as they check out of the supermarket, as they exit, as they pay for their groceries, sees the National Enquirer and sees those headlines. And almost everyone reads those headlines, right? The amount of work that they were doing for him, it's hard to fathom. And I think that creates some stakes for this case that maybe weren't there at the start.
Jeremy Stahl, I'm really grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Always happy to be here, Mary.
Jeremy Stahl covers the courts for Slate. And that's the show. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Alana Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Madeline Ducharme, and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. I'll catch you back here next time.